and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out, presented by War Scholar. Today I speak with Dr. Ofer Friedman, who's written a book on the term hybrid warfare. It's titled Russian Hybrid Warfare. And while that is about a contemporary issue, which is how both the Russia and the West interpret hybrid warfare, the talk goes into basically 20th century Russian thinking about warfare and some Russian military history back to the Russian Revolution, the Cold War, World War II. We get deeply into Russian thinking and also the West, but there is a lot about Russia. So definitely if you're a Russian military enthusiast, you'll definitely enjoy that this discussion. But also definitely interesting as far as modern military issues, contemporary military issues, and how conflict, soft conflict, you could say, is waged or thought about currently. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. Ofer Friedman, author of Russian Hybrid Warfare, Resurgence and Politicization. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for inviting me to speak.
So first, tell me how you got into studying this subject and writing about it.
Actually, this story that how I started this with this book and this research began in 2015, when two books navigated their way onto my table. Mm-hmm. The one was published by NATO, and it was called NATO's Response to Hybrid Threats. And another one was published in Russia, and it was called Hybrid Wars in the Chaotic World of the 21st Century. And it was obviously in Russian. Mm-hmm. And I was puzzled because when I read them both, I realized that despite the title, which is more or less the same, mm-hmm. And once you get two books published on the assumably same phenomenon, you expect to find inside something like different, maybe different perspectives, because one is published in the West and another one in Russia, mm-hmm. Different examples, but I expected to find something more or less similar, similar phenomenon discussed. Like, for example, you read about terrorism. If you read a book published in Russia about terrorism or in the West about terrorism, it will be different perspectives, but discussing more or less the same thing. Mm-hmm. When I read these two books about hybrid warfare, I was surprised because having the same title, they spoke about completely two different things. What is called in the West hybrid warfare, or at least what was called by NATO in 2015 as hybrid warfare, it's completely different in Russia. They call hybrid warfare, which I call in my book as гибридная война, mm-hmm. And I purposefully used this just to separate between two things. Mm-hmm. Гибридная война means in Russia hybrid warfare, in Russian, mm-hmm. But it's something completely different. Mm-hmm. So I started my journey from this, and I went into the long discourse, very rich discourse in the West. What is how the whole notion of hybrid warfare has been born, mm-hmm. and developed since it was first introduced about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, I went to analyze how did Russians come to this understanding of гибридная война, their way to understand hybrid warfare. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was the start of my journey.
So,
and this, realizing that they speak completely different language.
So, did you get your degree in this field? Is that is this?
my degree in politics, I specialize on strategy. Because I speak Russian, obviously, I specialize more on Russian military thinking, on Western military thinking as a equivalent of that, and making a comparison between these two. So no, it's not my degree about that. My degree more in a more general strategic studies. But it's just one of the cases that I decided to pick up because it was so interesting. And if you remember, 2014, 2015, especially in the Western discourse, this was the peak of Russian hybrid warfare.
So, and I ask because I'm curious if this grew out of, you know, how you do your thesis for your PhD, or if this was something that just came after you were done with your formal studies.
No. This is not my thesis. This is not my PhD. My PhD was about slightly different topic, unrelated to that. It was again. It was in my PhD was in the field of strategic studies, and I used the different cases of Russia and the United States and Israel. But this is already after my PhD. This is not my dissertation or something. It's my next project.
Okay. So let me ask about the book then. Can we start, I guess, in the little blurb about the book, it says, it mentions the 1960s where this, I guess the obsession, the blurb says an obsession with hybrid warfare started. Is that correct?
In 1960s?
Yes. In the blurb it says the 60s. So I'm just curious where that, you know, what that comes from.
I'm trying to find the blurb.
Okay, so that's incorrect.
Can you find in the blurb what it says in the 60s?
I can read the blurb. It says, Friedman contends that today's obsession with hybrid warfare is more to do with politics than conceptual novelty having been devised in the 1960s.
Okay. Now I know what you're talking about. So let's clarify a little bit what it says. The idea, the term itself, hybrid warfare, is relatively new. It exists for the last 10 years. And the main question, which I also investigate in my book, is, okay, we have a new term, but actually, is there anything new? Is it just a new terminology, or it's really a new phenomenon?
Okay.
And once I establish that there is little new in that phenomenon, then you can say, okay, let's put aside the title. Let's see the literature about the phenomenon, which might previously went under a different title. You see what I mean? So actually, when you kind of think about, okay, what is the concept? What is actually meaning of that? You can easily trace it to the literature in the West, and also in Russia, back to the 60s, at least, if not before, because if you start to analyze the phenomenon itself, not writing about it, but the phenomenon itself, it's as old as human history. So we have this phenomenon that has always been here, and then we have a theoretical writing about it, more or less all the time. You can find some clues also in Clausewitz and even as far as to Machiavelli. But then you have more politicization of that, and you have kind of more frequent writing about that and trying to conceptualize it even more in the 60s. And now we have this hybrid warfare, which is everybody is obsessed with. But historically speaking, in a phenomenon itself, as it conceptualized by NATO or by Russians, there is very little new.
Okay. So I guess let's talk about, you said there were you found differences. Can you compare and contrast, you know, the things you found?
Yeah. So when we're talking about hybrid warfare, and I will put it very straightforward, I don't like the term. And we can speak about that later. But there are three main conceptualizations, the three main concepts that come under the same title. So the first one was the original conceptualization, as it was proposed by Frank Hoffman, and it was developed in the U.S. military, mainly in the Marines, since 2007, 8, 9, 10, these years. Mm-hmm. And it basically means a blurring line between regular and irregular forces on the same battlefield. And it's important to say a few words about that. And there was a very nice book published by Williamson Murray about hybrid warfare in 2012, where he criticizing this idea and saying, actually, look, partisans or irregular fighters have been fighting with regular fighters for thousands of years, and he's right. The novelty of hybrid warfare back then in 2008 and 9, as it was proposed by Frank Hoffman, was the novelty was that we can see regular and irregular forces fighting on the same battlefield in the same battle space, which previously they were usually fighting different battles. Mm-hmm. So partisans in the Second World War were fighting separately from Red Army. Or in American Revolution, the irregular forces usually were fighting separately from regular forces, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. Now we can see them all blend together on the same battlefield. Mm-hmm. And the second novelty was the technological one. So if we go in, back in history, even to the Second World War, which it wasn't so far away, the technology available to regular military and to partisans or irregular forces were more or less similar. And if you go even further, when you think about it, the rifles and the military technology of partisans during the American Revolution, for example, were more or less similar to what the regular forces had. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, the technology available to regular forces, to the armies, and to guerrillas or to insurgencies are very different. And once you blend them together on the same battle, it did create something new. Mm-hmm. But so this was the initial hybrid warfare. Tactical, operational level. It's not about strategy. Mm-hmm. It's about new battlefield and how deal with a new type of enemy on tactical and operational level. Mm-hmm. Then, in 2010, NATO picked up these ideas and they started to play with it, and by its own very nature of NATO, it's not necessarily purely military organization, it also has political ingredients. So they tried to increase this kind of conceptual thinking to the level of strategy and bringing different aspects to that, like economy, information, cyber, and so on and so on. Then it was forgotten in 2012, and since 2014, the crisis in Ukraine and the Russian reaction to this crisis, NATO rediscovered this concept, basically saying that hybrid warfare is a combination of all possible hostile activities, whether they're military or non-military. As one of the advisors in NATO said, it's a combination of hard power and soft power. So basically bringing any hostile activity, whether it's coming in terms of tanks and bombs or economy, finance, diplomacy, espionage, and so on and so on, all this is a hybrid warfare. It's a very big, all-inclusive term. Mm-hmm. This is the second one. And the third one is actually Gebridne Vojna. It's how Russians define it. According to them, it's a mix of non-military means. So according to Russians, Gebridne Vojna doesn't include military deployment. So it's very non-military. It's diplomacy, it's economy, it's finance, information, and so on and so on. So we have kind of these three different types, three different definitions, three different understandings of what is a hybrid warfare. Tactical, operational, military, original one, non-military only by Gebridne Vojna, by Russians, or as is understood now, especially in Europe, in NATO, is everything. Everything which is hostile to us, it's a part of hybrid warfare.
So what would the Russians refer to a situation where, and, you know, since they have in World War II the history of partisans, you know, working alongside soldiers, what do they refer to as that situation where soldiers are fighting alongside partisans?
First of all, when we analyze the history of the Second World War, partisans were not fighting along with soldiers. Partisans were fighting different battles in different space.
Okay.
They were fighting in the rear of Germans. So soldiers were fighting on, at the front. They were not fighting in the same space.
Okay.
And it was partisan warfare, or we can call it insurgency warfare, we can call it partisan, guerrilla, whatever. And there is a regular fighting. So it was... they were fighting for the same cause, but they were fighting different battles in different ways and with different means, employing different methods. And there were instructions how to fight partisan warfare, and there were instructions how to fight regular warfare.
So they just differentiate it completely then. They don't...
Yeah, and also in the West, we have conceptual thinking. We can separate and distinguish between what is regular warfare and what is insurgency or partisans or freedom fighters, you know, or terrorists. It's kind of, you know, it's a matter of perspective. In the end of the story, they all employ more or less the same methods of sabotage and so on and so on.
So... did Hoffman consider that the irregular forces fell under the same chain of command as regular forces, or were they separate but just deconflicting, say?
No, according to Hoffman, and he based his analysis on mainly on the Second Lebanon War, analyzing Hezbollah, but then also bringing different some other cases, but this was the main case. What he was saying is, and I actually find the, his conceptualization the most interesting one, for several reasons. One of them, it doesn't go up to the level of strategy. It's trying to analyze what is going on the battlefield. What is the enemy that we face on tactical and operational level? And according to him, we have a mix of regular and irregular forces who have different training, who have different means and methods to fight, fighting under the same command against the very same enemy, employing different methods, using different technology, But all of them fighting in the same space, in the same battle space against the same enemy on tactical and operational level, and this is important. Mm-hmm. When we think about partisans during the Second World War, they were not fighting the same enemy. Yes, generally they were fighting the same enemy. They were fighting the Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. But they were not fighting the same units. Mm-hmm. They were not fighting in the same space.
So what is the practical effect then, these differences that you found? What does it matter in the end to how conflict is waged?
And this is what I argue in my book. The problem with term hybrid warfare is that it means everything and nothing. It's completely useless. Mm-hmm. Because different people, even in the same establishments, in the U.S. or in Europe or in Russia, for that matter, different people understand it differently. Mm-hmm. Depends what they have read before. It's so inclusive that you can't understand what it actually means. Mm-hmm. It has its own perks of being very good in for political purposes, mm-hmm. but for understanding of what is the confrontation about and how should we counteract it or how should we take an initiative in such confrontation, the whole concept, in my opinion, is completely useless. It's very good for politicians. Mm-hmm. Who want to delegitimize the enemy or unite the ranks among their voters or members of NATO, for example, to create this kind of feeling of a big evil enemy. Mm-hmm. And it works on both sides. Also in Russia, it's the same, in my opinion, it's the same purpose of the concept. Mm-hmm. But in terms of understanding on conceptual level what is going on, it's completely useless. And actually, it's not only useless, it actually makes more damage than help. Mm-hmm.
For everyone involved, or do you think?
No, it's not what is going on the ground. It's about what is going on between us and mm-hmm. what is going on between Russians with Russians. Mm-hmm. If we analyze what is going on in the West among the NATO member states or between different establishments within one state, between military and politicians, for example, we confuse ourselves. Mm-hmm. We say, oh, hybrid warfare, Russians do hybrid warfare. What does that mean?
Okay.
Because inside ourselves, each one of us understands it differently. Mm-hmm. And the same actually happens also in Russia. When they call Gibridna Vaina, the West is waging Gibridna Vaina against us, mm-hmm. they also don't have a common understanding. And this is before we actually go into the whole idea of why do we call it warfare? Why do we call it a war? It's a confrontation. Mm-hmm. War is a very specific, clearly defined phenomenon.
Right.
When we at war, we deploy troops and bombs falling from the sky. Mm-hmm. This is war. Mm-hmm. It's warfare. To call economic sanctions as a war, it's very nice for political reasons, because it helps to unite people mm-hmm. against one enemy. But it also confuses. It confuses us, because once we say a war, we expect our military to do something. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that it's a purpose of military establishment or military organization to defend our information space.
Hmm. Interesting.
And if it's not purpose of the military to defend our information space, then it's not a war, because once we're in war, military should be responsible.
Hmm. Yeah.
And if we're not in war, why do we call it as a war?
So, if we take the Ukraine crisis as an example, do you see that as a situation where everyone just described what was going on improperly and at cross purposes? You know, both sides were just talking past each other, or, you know, how would you... Can you use that as an example of where these definitions...
Ukrainian case is a very interesting example. If we take, like, because all three different definitions of war actually can happen, can use Ukraine as described, and it will suit their definition.
Mm-hmm.
When we take Hoffman's definition of hybrid warfare, which is operational tactical blending, then the separatists in eastern Ukraine present a hybrid enemy to Ukrainian military, because these separatists use they blend and mix regular and irregular forces. Sometimes there are some Russian forces there, so it's kind of Russian equipment there, so it's kind of a mix of regular and irregular.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, they present, according to Hoffman definition, on tactical operational level, a hybrid enemy to the Ukrainian military.
Mm-hmm.
When we are talking about NATO definition of hybrid warfare, which is everything hostile, then definitely Russia employs hybrid warfare.
Mm-hmm.
They use economic measurements against Ukraine, they use diplomacy, they use information, some would claim that they also use cyber, and also some military ingredient here in Crimea and also in eastern Ukraine. So yeah, perfectly, we can say that it's also fits NATO definition of hybrid warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And when we ask Russians, they would say obviously it fits also the definition of гибридная война, because what the West does in Ukraine, and against Russia, it's economics and information and all these kind of non-military means and methods.
Mm-hmm.
Against Russia. And this kind of situation, it would be fun if it would not be so sad.
Mm-hmm.
because it helps each side, on the one hand, to accuse the other side of employing hybrid methods against them.
Mm-hmm.
But also simultaneously it allows each side to fend off the accusations.
Mm-hmm.
Because we understand hybrid warfare differently, so whatever you accuse us, it's complete nonsense because we don't do it.
So it sounds like the definitions, you know, people would use them to say, okay, we've entered, you know, a period of war because we meet these definitions. It seems like the Russian definition is easier to meet, to say that you're at war, because it doesn't involve military, it involves a lot of softer things. Does that mean Russia would be more willing to go to war over softer methods than the West?
No, when you say war, do you mean like actual war?
Yes, like Russia could say they've crossed the red line because they've done these soft things that fall under hybrid warfare. We consider the West being at war with us. That's what I'm conjecturing.
Well, you have to be very cautious when you speak about hybrid warfare or гибридная война in actual military, like real military actions, because in fact none of the militaries in the West or in Russia officially recognize this term.
Mm.
So if you go to the military dictionaries, which will define irregular warfare, irregular warfare, and so on and so on, mm-hmm. you will not find hybrid warfare there. Hmm. If you go to the U.S. military dictionary, you will not find hybrid warfare there. If you go to the Russian military dictionary, you will not find гибридная война there. Hmm. It's not a, as I said, for military, all military, and I served in the military by myself for 15 years. Military are very professional, pragmatic, conceptual institutions. Mm-hmm. They want to have definitions for very clear phenomena to which they will have to find solutions. Military is not responsible for non-military activities. Mm-hmm. So for military, it's very confusing, because we call it, people call it, journalists call it, politicians call it a war. Mm-hmm. But it's not under responsibility of the military, and I'm not sure that we actually want our military to be responsible for that.
Right.
To solve the problem.
Okay, so now I understand better the things you were saying at the start. Make more sense.
Yeah,
it seems more a tool of the politician. It seems a tool of politicians than, as you say, journalists.
Yeah, and this is why the book is called Politicization. Mm-hmm. The politicians found it very helpful. This term, mm-hmm. because it allows them to take any hostile action conducted by adversary and call it a war. Mm-hmm. And once people are told that they are at war, they are, whether people in general, like electorate or decision makers, their readiness to do something about increases significantly.
Yeah. So, can you tell me how you researched this book? Did you interview for the? Did your research? Did you interview people? You know, what did you consult?
I conducted several interviews, but the book, the main purpose of the book, was actually to trace the discourses. Mm-hmm. So it involved much reading of publications and, for example, how the understanding of hybrid warfare in the West have transformed through the years. Mm-hmm. So initially it meant something A, and then have become to be something A plus 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 plus. So it involved much reading of publications, whether they were books or articles or official documents, which discussed what is hybrid warfare, how we understand it, what should be done, why should we do that, and so on and so on. And the same on the Russian side. And what is interesting is that on the Russian side, all this discourse of гибридная война, it's relatively new. It's actually began in 2014, only as a response to the accusations of the West that the Russia conducts hybrid warfare. So the term itself is relatively new. But when you trace Russian discourse about the role, the phenomenon of гибридная война, as they define it, mm-hmm. it's very interesting, because they have been talking about that for more or less since the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Because according to them, and by the way, it's not necessarily matter whether it's true or not, but Russians believe that they lost the Cold War. In this kind of non-military confrontation, which included economy and information and so on and so on. And they kind of, they're blaming the West, but they're also blaming the Soviet leadership, which couldn't face it or couldn't respond to the Western activities in that field. So what happened, and this is kind of, it's a known fact that the best students of the previous war are usually those who were defeated but not conquered. And you can think about, and you can think about the example of Germany in the in the interwar period. So what happened to Russia is that they were defeated in the Second War, in the Cold War, but they were not conquered. They were not integrated.
Right.
And if there was a period in initial in the first half of 90s that were trying to push themselves and say to the West, we lost, so please integrate us. The West wasn't much ready for that.
Right.
So the, once they realized that the door is closed, they started to look their own way, and the first thing that they did it's to analyze their defeat. Why we Russians would say why we were defeated, and their ultimate answer was because of non-military confrontation. Which included diplomacy, economics, information, and so on and so on.
In Russia, compared to the West, as far as writing about these issues, is there a lot of freedom for disagreement and you know, contrasting opinions, or is it more controlled? Is there more of a...
It's complete freedom. It's complete freedom of writing. It's and Russians have always been in terms of conceptual thinking, military thinking. They are very open. Even during the Soviet time, there were relative openness to new ideas. There are stages. There are certain platforms where you can express your opinions, like journals, books, and so on and so on. So, you know, it's complete open writing, and you can trace actually people who already started to write about that in the early 90s, almost immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which wasn't that popular. And also, the, until today, you have much disagreement about, not only about why the Cold War ended, but also what should be done now. So there is a very much freedom of speech. Actually, this is not the issue.
Okay.
The issue is that they have been learning their lessons while the West was in a kind of euphoria of winning the and you see that there is a problem that we define winning and losing. In my opinion, the end of the Cold War, everybody should won.
Right.
But we kind of we successfully avoided a nuclear disaster. So, in my opinion, the feeling should be that everybody won, but apparently the West think that the West won, the Russians think that they lost. Now they analyzed their lessons. They learned their lessons, and this is why they have an advantage, as it seems so far.
Interesting. So, was there a part of the research that was particularly enjoyable for you to do?
There was a very interesting story. It's described in the book. So I wanted to understand when and how what Russians did in Crimea and in Ukraine was actually called hybrid warfare. Okay. Because they started to do it, was 2014, they actually, hybrid war, the concept itself was there for 8 years. So I tried to find, okay, how and who was the first to call them. There were several people who already in April 14 kind of tried to imply that this is hybrid warfare, but it didn't catch. The first and most influential source was a short documentary produced by NATO about what Russians did in Crimea. And the title that this the director of this documentary decided to give to this short documentary is hybrid warfare. And then it basically was like a bushfire. And everybody, I can actually trace the publications. Everybody would refer to this documentary saying, look, NATO actually already calls it as a hybrid warfare. And I spoke with the director of this documentary in NATO. It was published by NATO, produced by NATO. And he's civilian. He's a civilian employed by NATO magazine. I spoke with him and asked him, okay, why did you call it hybrid warfare? You know, there was a whole concept and a whole literature of what is hybrid warfare. Why did you call it like that? To what his response was, well, I wasn't aware about anything written about hybrid warfare before. It just seemed to be a combination of regular or something different methods employed by Russians in Crimea, and hybrid sounds evil. And then what happened immediately, like a bushfire, researchers all across Europe started to write about that and make the connection, referring to this documentary as acknowledgement of NATO that what Russians do is hybrid warfare. So basically, hybrid warfare is popular because one director who just decided to give it a title.
Yeah. An evil-sounding title.
And it sounds evil. Yeah exactly.
So I know you went into the research knowing about the differences that you would see, but did you find something that was particularly surprising to you as you went along?
I got some surprise when I was researching Russian side. First of all, I found this amazing, it's not the right word, interesting guy whose name is Messner. I have a chapter about him, Evgeny Messner. His story is very interesting. He was born in the late 19th century. He was a Russian imperial officer. And during the Bolshevik Revolution, he was fighting with the White Movement against the Bolsheviks. And then he escaped to Belgrade, where he continued his military service, or whatever you call it. He was teaching in the officer courses in Belgrade. Also publishing and engaging in research on military. And then during the Second World War, he joined the Wehrmacht to fight against the Soviets again. And when he lost again, he escaped to Argentina. Where he continued his research and publications and writing, trying to analyze his experience and of both wars, and we have the Cold War in the background. So he was a very conservative in his thinking. Mm-hmm. He was very anti-communist. You have to remember he was publishing in Russian in Argentina, mm-hmm. with very limited readership. So his writings are very honest in terms of, you know, he was selling about 200 books. Mm-hmm. So he didn't care about censorship or even self-censorship. So he was very honest. Sometimes it's very difficult to read. He was very conservative, very nostalgic. Very much against any social changes, very much anti-communist, seeing this communist conspiracy everywhere, accusing the West of being weak in its fight against communism. Mm-hmm. He lost his motherland twice to the Soviets, and so on and so on. So obviously he wasn't known in the Soviet Union, as you would expect.
Okay.
His books reached Soviet Union. They were collected in a restricted area in the National Library. I found them there in original copies. Mm-hmm. Probably they were available for a very limited number of high-level officials, officers, or I don't know. But they were forbidden for general public. Obviously, or for general readership. Mm-hmm. What happened? Now I'm jumping to the collapse of the Soviet Union. What happened in the Soviet after the collapse of the Soviet Union? The Russian military lost its philosophy of war, and philosophy of war is very important. This is how you understand the reasons of war. And during the Soviet Union, it was explained by Marxism, Leninism ideology, the struggle between classes and so on and so on. Once the Soviet Union fell apart, Russian military find itself in a problem. They don't have an explanation to the very phenomenon of war. So they started to look and research. And they went back to imperial writings, but also went back to the writings of immigrants who escaped after the Bolshevik revolutions to the West. One of them was Messner, and apparently Messner has become to be very popular because in the military circles, he was since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the last, 27 years, he was republished at least 5, 6 or maybe more times.
Oh, wow.
Different editions, different books, sometimes books by him own, only his writings, sometimes as a collection of different writers, but he was quite widely republished. And what they're saying is, and it is interesting, like he was anti-communist, he was anti-Russia. What is interesting, what they say, like, look, he was right. And what happened is that the West listened, because one of his arguments was that the Soviet Union employs different non-military means against the West. Propaganda, economics, information, politics, ideology. The Soviet Union tried, according to him, was trying to undermine the political establishment of the West. Mm-hmm. So what the Russians are saying now is, look, yeah, he was right, but to the accuracy of 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. The West, in the end, learned its lessons and employed what Messner was writing about against the Soviet Union.
Hmm. Interesting.
And this revival of Messner writings across Russian political, professional, and military experts was one of the main reasons, or one of the foundation stones of this understanding, which in the end led to this idea of hybridna vojna. In 2000s, more or less since the late 90s until 2012, more or less, there were several schools, we'll put it, several terms or several types of warfare, whatever you call it, the title doesn't matter. They all were talking about the same thing, about the glue, in a nuclear stalemate, combined with contemporary technological and informational environment, non-military means and methods are much more effective. Mm-hmm. And their purpose is not to conquer. There is no purpose of conquering states anymore. It's even not to fight. It's just to undermine your the legitimacy of your, the political legitimacy of your adversary. Mm-hmm. Let them fight one with another. Mm-hmm. Inside, it's about weakening the cohesion of the adversary society.
Yeah.
There are three main school of conceptual thinking that I identified in the book. One of them is Messner and his idea of subversion war. Another one is Igor Panarin with his information war, and Alexander Dugin with his net-centric war. The titles are different, the mechanics and explanations are different, but on the in the bottom line, they're all talking about the same thing. It's undermining the legitimacy, or the political legitimacy of your adversary, and its social political cohesion by non-military means and methods. Mm-hmm. And this is what actually Hybridna Vojna is, according to Russians. Hmm.
So, because of nuclear weapons, the big states, nation states, aren't going to attack each other externally. Instead, you attack your enemy from within, and watch them collapse.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, but again, there is very little new in that conceptual thinking. Hmm. When you think about it, like just as a short trip to the history. French did the same with Americans against the Brits. Mm-hmm. In the first years of American Revolution, mm-hmm. French were in peace with Britain. Mm-hmm. Brits did the same, creating the Arab Revolt during the First World War. Mm-hmm. Bolsheviks were supported by Germans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The United States staged a coup in Iran. Mm-hmm. So that there is once a state doesn't want to use military means, and the reasons are, it doesn't matter what the reasons why a state doesn't want to fight military. Maybe it's incapable of. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not ready. Maybe it's too weak. Maybe it's just not ready to bear the consequences. Mm-hmm. But once a state is not ready to fight military against an adversary or perceived adversary, employing non-military means and methods conceptually is a very old thing. Everybody was doing that.
It makes me think of the Byzantine Empire. They had a small
army. Exactly. I didn't want to bring the examples from ancient history, but you can go as far as you wish.
Yeah. Interesting.
Now we have a slightly different technology. We have slightly different information space. We have slightly different economic tools that we can use. But the idea that, okay, we are not ready to fight it with weapons, let's try to do something else. Let's try to employ different means to undermine the leader of the political establishment of my adversary. It's very old trick. And by the way, the fact that we have Facebook now and the fact that we have global economy does not necessarily make it easier.
Yeah. So, what do you hope the book will do?
My hope is that the book will cool down the discourse. It will never happen. but the idea here of the book is A, to cool down. Like, not necessarily, it's not that we don't have a problem. It's not that we don't have a confrontation between the West and Russia. We do. But we have to approach this confrontation with much less emotions and much more professionally. And hybrid warfare, this old notion of hybrid warfare, this hybrid warfare narrative, it's all about emotions. Because politicians operate with emotions.
Right.
So if we want to solve the problem, and eventually we do want to solve the problem, everybody wants to, this is my belief, because, you know, if we don't want to solve a problem, then we ultimately will find ourselves in another Cold War or even worse. But to solve the problem, we have to cool down our emotions and approach it professionally, understand, okay, there is very little new in that. We have many historical examples when the same methods were used. Now, let's call things by their own names. We have espionage. We know how to deal with espionage. We have economy. We know how to deal with economy. We have economic confrontation. We know how to deal with that. We have political differences. We know how to do that. If we have military differences and we want to solve problem militarily, no problem. We know how to do it. This is why we pay so much money for our departments of defense.
Right.
Let's see the trees in the forest, not the forest.
Right.
So my hope is that it will cool down first, and second, and this is kind of what I'm dealing with in the conclusions, is to understand why or where from this hysteria is coming from about all this Russian. Why do we so much misunderstand them? And the problem is not with them. Usually they're very good at telling us what they're doing. Putin is very consistent in what he's saying. Each time we're surprised that actually he said and did. But apparently his signaling is very much obvious. So the problem is with us. We lost our expertise in Russia for several reasons, which I explain in the book. The first one, the second one is we have many problems with us. They're all, what the Russians are doing, it's basically identifying our weaknesses. And adding fuel into already existing fires. They're very good. They know us much better than we know them.
Yeah, I could see that.
They traveled much more. When you think about it, in Russia, even let's say in Russian academia, to be promoted in academia, you have to spend time in the West. Whether it's to study degree or to some kind of visiting position or so on and so on and so on. The number of Western academics who go to Russia is limited to the Russian experts.
Right.
But an average Russian professor, let's say, in political philosophy, who is not expert on the Western political philosophy. He is just a professor in political philosophy. He would spend time in the West, a year or two, doing something. Mm-hmm. How many political philosophers in the West spend time in Russia, who are not experts in Russia?
Yeah, very few.
And this is where it all begins.
Huh. It's fascinating.
This is, you know, we have to understand them. And this is where it begins. It begins with philosophy and political philosophy. Yeah, but mathematics are important, but mathematics, they all travel and speak with each other. Mm-hmm. Even during the Soviet times, the exchange among science, hard science, was very frequent. They were moving and exchanging and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. The problem with the social science, how many psychologists who do not focus on Russia, Western psychologists who do not focus on Russia, spend time in Russia? Hmm. I don't know any. I assume that the number is very small, if at all.
Right.
And by the way, we will find the same problem very soon if the confrontation with China will continue. We will find ourselves in the same situation. We don't understand them on a very basic level. So this is the first what I'm trying to achieve is in this book, my hope is to understand the problem. We don't want Second Cold War.
Right.
It's none. It's human beings on this planet. Cold War is a very expensive, usually in terms of money, but also in terms of human lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thing. We don't want to get there. But actually, by talking about this hybrid warfare, we talk ourselves into it.
Yeah. Yeah, you could see that. So, can you tell me any difficulties you had in finishing the book or getting it published and how you overcame those?
No, it went actually quite smooth. So, I would not say that it was difficult with the publisher or something like that. Initially, when I proposed this project to my publisher, they liked it from the very beginning. Just to remind you, it was 2015 so when I kind of started to think about it. Mm-hmm. Late 2015. It took me a year to write and a year to publish, so it was very quick. Mm-hmm. Also probably because of the relevance of the book. Mm-hmm. To the ongoing discourse. I would say I didn't experience any significant problems with that.
Okay. What's your next writing project?
Now it's more kind of a continuation from this project. Mm-hmm. As I already told you, there are some interesting stuff that I figure out about Russian contemporary military thinking, or more importantly, what are the philosophical sources? Like, what is Russian Clausewitz? Yeah, obviously they read Clausewitz, but they have all their own Clausewitz. Several of them. Mm-hmm. And when I did this project and I read Russian contemporaries' strategic thinking and how they explain strategy and war and the interaction between politics and military, I found out a very interesting thing that while in the West, when you read the Western publications on Russian military, the research always begins with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And then it usually will trace the transformation from the Soviet Union to Russian, from the Soviet military to Russian military. And it doesn't necessarily matter whether we're talking about hardware or software in terms of thinking, whether we're talking about the military reforms in terms of the how we use the forces, or kind of thinking, more philosophical kind of art of war thinking. Mm-hmm. It's either transformation, or now it's very popular, the comeback. It's kind of, they're coming back to the Soviet roots. Mm-hmm. But actually, when I read Russian publications, they root their contemporary understandings in three different schools of thinking. The first one is Soviet, yes, it's obviously there. Mm-hmm. But the Soviet thinking share equally, I would say, even its place with Russian imperial thinking, mm-hmm. military, and military thinkers in exile.
Okay.
What is interesting here is that the last two, the Russian imperial military thinking and exile, people who wrote in exile after the Bolshevik revolutions, they're completely out of the view of the Western experts. Because the basis for our contemporary Russian military studies in English were written during the Soviet times. And in Soviet times, these two schools were forbidden. So they left completely unnoticed by the Western experts who analyzed the Soviet military during the Cold War. And now on, when experts start to analyze Russia, they ultimately go back to the Soviet times, because many of them just simply unaware of this literature, which has become to be very popular in Russia in the last two decades. So the idea is to dig into this on the one hand, to try to analyze these schools of thinking separately, like what was the military thinking in the late Russian Empire, second part of the 19th century, just before the First World War, mm-hmm. And then to analyze separately what was the common narratives among the military officers who were writing in exile during the 30s, 40s, 60s, up to the 70s. And then through the prism of Soviet military thinking, the literature in the West and Soviet military thinking is very rich, so I don't need to dig into this.
Okay.
But then to try to take these three and analyze their role and place, use them as a prism to analyze what Russians are doing now.
Okay. So the current book, people can find that on Amazon and on Oxford University Press website. Do you have a personal website or anything that people can follow your thoughts or stuff you're writing?
I have my page on academia.edu, mm-hmm. If I publish something, I either post it there if it's an open access, or I post a link to an article or any other publication that I publish. Mm-hmm. They can find me on academia.edu very easily, and just to follow.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
Well, actually, as a final word, I will read the annotation of the book, the first two lines.
okay.
which actually do not belong to me, they belong to George Orwell. But if the thoughts corrupt language, language can also corrupt thoughts. A bad usage can spread by tradition and imitation even among people who should and do know better. And this is what hybrid warfare, the language of hybrid warfare is about. It's a circle where the language corrupts our thinking and our thinking corrupts our language. It's a closed circle, and to find a solution we have to break it, approach the problem with much more professional and sober understanding, stop being emotional, and solve the problem.
Alright, well, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name Chris does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.